WNUCLP 96.7 FM Detroit.
This is Peace Talks Radio, a series on peacemaking and nonviolent conflict resolution. We put the spotlight on peacemakers throughout history and today, whether it's the search for inner peace or learning how to resolve conflicts we have with others in our families, workplaces, communities, or between nations. We consider it here on Peace Talks Radio. I'm producer Paul Ingalls, and some of you will know that in 2002, Suzanne Kreider and I co-founded this program. Suzanne was the original host, and then she shared co-hosting duties for many years with Carol Boss and myself.
Welcome to Peace Talks, making peace with ourselves since 9/11. I'm Suzanne Kreider, speaking to you from an auditorium on the campus of the University of New Mexico in Albuquerque. An audience is gathered here to explore the mystery.
From May of 2012 through this program, though, you haven't heard much from Suzanne. And there's a reason for that. Suzanne is here with me in the studios to host her first show since then. So welcome back, Suzanne.
Thank you.
It's great to have you here. Early in May 2012, something happened that forced your hiatus. You were in your apartment in Washington, D.C.
Yes.
So tell us what went down that night.
I had a little headache. Very unusual for me because I rarely get headaches. So I thought, well, you need to eat. So I had something to eat and it did not go away. I tried to talk out loud to myself and I sounded funny. So I called a friend of mine and I said, "This is Suzanne Kreider." And she said, "I don't know what you just said. Go to an emergency room." Well, that freaked me out. And so I stood up and I could not walk. And I just said, "Oh no, this cannot be happening. No, I cannot be having a stroke." So I walked over, walking, kind of holding on to stuff, to the wall where the door to my apartment opens, and I knocked on the door of the guy next door to me, Paulie. He came to the door in his underwear. And I said to him, "Paulie, I'm having a stroke. Can you please take me to an emergency room?" He was so funny. If you can see a guy who is about 30, he's 6'5", he weighs 250 pounds, he is a bartender, and he looks at me and laughs and says, "Suzanne, I'm drunk and I have no clothes on." And it was the perfect humor I needed. I said, "Paulie, I'm having a stroke here." And he said, "I'll be back in a second." He slammed the door on me. I'm holding on to the wall. So I went in my apartment and I got my phone, my keys, my cards, a little money, all I had. I came back out and he was there and he said, "Suzanne, I'm still drunk, but I have clothes on now. Come on, we're going." And he puts his arm around me and he walks me down the hall to the elevator. And as he's taking me, he is calling on his phone an ambulance and telling them what I told him. I never lost consciousness. So I don't remember going in, but what happened was they put me in an MRI machine right away, and I came out very fast. I said, "What happened?" He said, "You did not have a stroke. You had an AVM.
AVM.
Arterial venal malformation. It is congenital. You've had it since birth, but it was behind the cerebellum." The cerebellum is the lower, older part of the brain, and it controls everything. It controls your walking, your talking, your balance.
Right. So there was some bleeding in that area as a result of this.
You have veins and arteries, but no capillaries in between. So what happened was the blood is rushing down into the artery, and there's no capillaries. So the blood just explodes out.
Too much pressure.
Yeah, too much pressure.
What actually kicked off the episode?
Well, we really don't know. I have done research on AVMs since that time and read that if you are born with this in your brain, or it can be anywhere in the body, often people who have these have an event in their 20s. Mm. So it was very unusual that I had it late in life at 57. I think it had something to do with pressure and maybe high blood pressure. Mm. So if you have high blood pressure, if you have any unusual symptoms, I don't want to scare you, but maybe you should get an MRI.
Yeah, talk to somebody for sure. So you're in the hospital and they've told you the diagnosis, and essentially they need to get your permission to do some fairly adventurous surgery on your brain.
A neurologist came into my room and said, oh, we need to take out the AVM in your brain. And I just laughed. I thought, I'm not going to do this. But I knew nothing about what happened to me. And sometimes I think, oh, I shouldn't have had someone cut my brain for the surgery. However, I already had these symptoms.
Right.
And I've since asked a neurologist. She confirmed that the symptoms I have now were due to the bleeding that happened immediately of the AVM. Mm-hmm. It was not the surgery.
But you approved the surgery. It sounds like they went in and did what they intended to do and what they normally do with this procedure.
Yeah.
Out of surgery, what I recall you telling me then is that there was a wide range of recovery arc.
They wouldn't tell me much because they don't want to promise too much. They said the first month is really hard, and they said it's important that you have speech and physical therapy. Mm-hmm. They said you will recover probably for up to a year or two. However, I've met people who've had strokes in the brain, and they've said, oh, I'm recovering for 25 years, and I have seen recovery in myself.
Right. My experience of staying in touch with you and seeing you some in D.C. is that you made a consistent progress in speech and mobility. I mean, you were using a walker at first and then a cane and then getting around without all that within 3 or 4 months. But what other phases would you say that you went through emotionally, because this leads into the topic of our program today, which is an exploration of conflict around disability, internal conflict, conflict in society, conflict between other people. How would you summarize your sort of emotional phases coming out of this experience?
They were awful. Emotionally, I had an awful time in the hospital. I don't want to say what happened, but just imagine the worst. And I lost a lot of weight because the food was bad. I didn't want to eat the food. I had an awful time. My sister came and finally got me out of the hospital. Emotionally, I was really a wreck. And I can remember she came and got me, and I was afraid to get in the ambulance and go home.
Why were you afraid?
Because I didn't want the ambulance to jostle my brain. Mm-hmm. And so I have come a long way. Like you said, I'm now walking without a cane. I can talk enough so that people understand me.
So what you're describing is that your relationship with the world starts to change, really.
Yes.
You're hypersensitive to things that normally before weren't issues. Riding in a cab, moving, walking, being with people.
Yes. And I went through this phase of really being embarrassed to be out in the world because I was falling over. I had a walker. I looked 80 years old. Nothing against people who were older, but I was 57 and going through this, and I'm super fit. So it was really hard to all of a sudden have everything taken away.
Yeah, right.
I still feel sad about that.
Yeah. So you were describing to me having to go through a mourning period.
Yes. Well, I had a meditation teacher who is also a therapist say to me, "Suzanne, of course you are upset. You lost the most important person in your life." So when he said that, I realized, oh, I should be grieving. This is like a mourning because I lost the ability to drive. I don't see well. I lost the ability to hike, camp, backpack, make choices about everything I do. So I'm really a different person, and I really lost this person who was so important to me. Suzanne Kreider. She was so healthy and so fit and so great. I loved her. She's gone. She will never be back. Mm-hmm. So now I'm learning how to mourn her loss, which I don't know. Our friend of mine recently said, he's a therapist too. I said, "How long will I be mourning this loss?" And he said, "I don't know. Maybe your whole life."
You're listening to Peace Talks Radio, the series on peacemaking and nonviolent conflict resolution. I'm series producer Paul Ingalls, and today we're looking at how people with disabilities learn to manage the upset and conflict within, and how they handle conflicts they may encounter interacting with others in society. Our guide is our own Suzanne Kreider, co-founder of Peace Talks Radio, who's returning from a 2-year hiatus following an AVM, an arterial venal malformation in her brain that she had appear suddenly in 2012. The event left her with stroke-like symptoms of compromised speech and movement. Her recovery continues as we talk with her today. She's come up with a list of questions and observations she wants to ask our other guests about later in the program.
Is there a goal for people who are disabled? Should we try to be mainstreamed? Should we try to fit in? I'm also looking at the relationship between what I call disabled versus non-disabled people. So there might be a conflict. And also, I want to know, how can disabled and non-disabled people make better peace? How can they get along?
What kind of interactions have you had with people that model a empathetic or a gap-closing protocol that feels useful to you? Like, that's how I'd like to be treated.
Okay, I have three things I've come up with. QAH. Q is questions. Ask any question you want. I don't care. I will talk about my disability. A is advice. Do not give advice. I don't need your advice. I'm 57. No, I'm 59 years old. I don't need your advice. I've had people tell me, "Oh, you need to eat this. You need to do this. You need to do acupuncture. You need to do tapping. You need to do cranial sacral therapy." I've had people do all of these crazy things. Don't give me advice, okay? And H is help. Don't give me help. Don't come up and try and make me walk a certain way. Don't hold on to me. Don't give me help. Ask me, "Is there anything you want help with?" I will say no, okay? What I say to people is, if I am picking up a knife with the pointed end, tell me. If I am going to walk into traffic, tell me. But you would do that with anyone. But anything else, I do not need your help. Mm-hmm. Giving help that is not asked for is inappropriate.
And then have you asked advice from anybody, like therapists or medical people?
I do. Physical therapists, speech therapists, and even doctors. But you know what? They don't know what your life is like. They have seen people who they have helped in physical therapy. I do want to know about that. But it's not like someone who is with you 24/7. I have had a friend say, "Oh, this is like aging." No, this is not aging, okay? It's not aging. So it's having stuff in your life that you had taken away in an instant. It's a bummer.
It's a bummer. And it makes you angry sometimes.
I'm angry a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I mean, I know I could meditate, I could take happy pills, I could relax, but there's something about me being me, and I'm just so interested in how I am reacting to this disability without what I call laying on stuff. I'm just me. And yeah, this is a bummer. I'm telling the truth.
Peace Talks Radio co-founder and show host Suzanne Kreider, who experienced an AVM, an arterial venal malformation, in 2012. The temporary bleeding in her brain left her with some stroke-like symptoms of compromised movement and speech. There's a longer version of my conversation with her online at peacetalksradio.com. She's returning to host today's program after a 2-year hiatus. So let's now hear part of Suzanne's interview with Dr. Susan Stutzner, professor in the Department of Leadership and Counseling at the University of Idaho. Dr. Stutzner herself suffered a spinal injury when she was 19 and has been a paraplegic using a wheelchair ever since, and teaching and studying about the world of disability. She's author of the book Living with Disability, Finding Peace Amidst the Storm.
What does research say about persons without disability? Do they often have biases and insecurities about people with disabilities?
Yes, actually there are. People without disabilities may see someone who has a disability and then feel threatened. It's kind of like the person becomes a visual reminder of their own mortality, what they call death anxiety. There's others who live without a disability who may try to socially distance themselves from people with disabilities because they're concerned about being socially ostracized by their peers or friends. So that does definitely happen.
Talk more about this death anxiety. What is that?
When someone who does not have a disability sees someone who does, they might have a conscious or unconscious thought such as, what if that happened to me? Or there's a tendency for people to want to blame the person with the disability because then it gives others reassurance that if they do all the right things, then a disability will never happen. But what people don't realize is that sometimes life just happens. You know, you could make all positive choices and do all the right things according to our societal moral conduct and still have a disability.
You have a background of a disability as well as you understand the psychological reasoning because you have a counseling degree. So why do some people feel more like, oh my gosh, they feel their mortality more than another person who will not blame the disabled person?
Well, I think a part of that comes to the meaning that people ascribe to it. Within our own society, westernized society, people often view living with a disability as a negative thing, something that they would rather avoid, or that if it occurs, it's almost equated with a death sentence to the extreme. But what they don't understand is that many people with a disability find positive things that develop in their life because of their disability. For example, some people may report that they have a deeper level of friendship, or they have found a more meaningful purpose in life, or somehow their life has been positively transformed. Okay, so people who cope well have found a way to the other side so that their disability becomes a positive transformation.
What would you add to this list from your book, which, by the way, I agree with your list, and it's of things that non-disabled people shouldn't do if they want to make peace with disabled people. One of them is offer unwanted help. I hate that. Another is assume disabled people can't do something. And another one is make a disabled person into a superhero. Explain what you mean when you write, don't make a disabled person a superhero.
Okay, well, sometimes when you have a disability, people will treat you as you're Superman, you know, because you have defied the odds or you have overcome a situation that society or people without disabilities would deem amazing. And so they may say something like, oh, wow, you know, you're just great. I don't know how you do that. I could never do that. All right. The catch to this is that many people who I believe are well-meaning individuals who don't have a disability think they're doing something kind by telling you how great you are, okay, and how well you're doing. But the harm is that the focus is only on your disability. It's not about, gee, you're wearing really great shoes today, or I really like your outfit. You know, some kind of conversation that would be normal among people who didn't have a disability.
Susan, explain what passing is.
Okay. Sometimes people with a disability may feel the need to conceal or act as if they don't have a disability. Okay, so where you may see this is when someone has an invisible condition. Perhaps it's a mental health diagnosis or a learning disability, or maybe it's a health condition such as cardiac problems that maybe isn't noticeable to the average person. And so rather than have the attention focus on them and their disability, they will try to act as if it's not there. And so therefore pass as someone who doesn't have a disability.
I do that a lot, and it's really bad, but I walk kind of funny, and I try to pass off like I'm walking normally. And I do that because I think I should have as a goal to mainstream back into the non-disabled world that I came from. So what should people do who are disabled instead of passing?
Well, I think a better option may be to be forgiving of yourself when you're not able to pass or to pass all the time. Certainly people who have an invisible disability have the option of not disclosing or making their disability noticeable to other people. But when it's visible, people may do the best they can to conceal it. And I'm certainly not saying that a person shouldn't try to do that. But I'm also saying that it's important to be okay with who you are and to forgive yourself if you're not able to pass.
I got the sense from your book that you believe there's really no reason to talk about our disability, but that goes against one of my three requests. I request of people, ask any question you want. And I thought that was a good request to me because it teaches people to ask questions rather than telling me. It also gives me an opportunity to educate people. So what do you feel, or what does the research say is the best thing to do to make peace?
Well, I think you could ask 5 different people and probably get 5 different answers. There will certainly be some individuals such as yourself that feel it works better for them to educate people. And in my book, I talk about that really what is most important is to find what works for you. Within the research, we know that it helps to have a sense of humor, to not take yourself quite so seriously. And so sometimes if something is brought to your attention, or say your disability is brought to out in the open, if there's a way that you can use that situation in a humorous fashion to put people at ease, that tends to work a little bit better.
I wonder, are disabled people trying to fix things and make peace more so than non-disabled people, or is it the other way around?
That, too, is a good question. I think society kind of expects people who have a disability to make them comfortable. But, you know, I think what would be best is if both sides or both groups, you know, could take a certain amount of responsibility and do this in collaboration.
How can I collaborate? Let's say I have different friends. Do I just bring it up and say, let's collaborate on this?
Well, I think a good place to start is for people, the better someone with a disability knows themselves, the better they can teach others how to treat them. What I do is, with people who I'm friends with, I just know and trust that my situation will be talked about eventually, but it's not the first thing that we talk about. And that's because the people who I've become friends with in my lifetime see me as a person and they want to know me for who I am. Then it may be 1 month, 2 months, 6 months down the road that we have some conversation and they let me bring it up according to whenever I want to. You know, in other words, they don't feel the need to learn about this part about myself until I'm ready to talk about it. If somebody, on the other hand, feels more comfortable in sharing it up front with their friends, then by all means do that.
I'm so curious how people learn about how to treat disabled people. So is there anything you recommend that we could teach parents or educators on how to interact with people with disabilities?
Within the public school system, that certainly a lot of learning could happen, you know, within the classroom, teachers, administrators, as they got more inclusive and more comfortable with students with disabilities or with introducing some of their students to professionals with disabilities so that they learn to see this as a more normalized experience, not just as something that happens by chance. I think also as parents, you know, certainly parents can learn to treat people with disabilities with respect because children will model after their parents. So that is certainly one way to approach this. You know, another is, you know, just changing the whole societal framework of how we view diversity. So my question is, why aren't we acting in ways that respect diversity? We're just not all going to look the same, act the same, be the same. And it's the ways in which we're different, you know, that make this a great place to live.
Dr. Susan Stutzner, University of Idaho professor and author of Living with Disability, Finding Peace Amidst the Storm. For an hour-long version of this program and for longer, complete versions of both my conversation with Suzanne Kreider and Suzanne's interview with Dr. Stutzner and Suzanne's interviews with attendees at a 2013 Disability Issues Conference in Albuquerque, New Mexico, check out the Making Peace with Disability episode from May 2014 on our website, peacetalksradio.com. That's peacetalksradio.com, where you can hear all the episodes in our series going back to 2002. That's where you can learn how to support this work, too, with a tax-deductible contribution. Sign up for a free newsletter, podcast, or order CDs, and to find loads of other resources, too. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter. That helps as well. The series stays on the air because of support from people like you and by the Paul Ray Peace Prize and KUNM at the University of New Mexico. For Suzanne Kreider, I'm Paul Ingalls. Thanks for listening to and for supporting Peace Talks Radio.
WNUC LP 96.7 FM Detroit.